Greetings. Welcome to Confessing the Blues. I'm your host, Jim Ange Anderson. Welcome to part two of our interview with singer, songwriter, percussionist, and drummer, Jeff Harrell. In last week's episode, we talked about songs from his new CD, Neepy. Let's pick it up where we left off. Let's roll. Have a American Indian heritage,
yes.
so there's some of that music involved on the CD. Can you talk about that?
Yes, my father, I get it through my father. My father was Lakota blood. My grandmother was full blood Lakota, born on the Pine Ridge Reservation in 1883, 7 years before Wounded Knee. And I believe she was born near Wounded Knee, but she was adopted as a baby and. To a family from the Wayot tribe, from the Miami band of Indians, and they took her to Southern Illinois, where this family was from, and that's where she was raised. And it was through the Presbyterian Church, so she was raised a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
But my father, my father still grew up with Indian because he did have the blood, and he did have the family, but still even though they were they were Christian and. And into that part of society,
right?
That's the spiritual end of it. My dad was still had these, still had the culture in him, and I mean, and he brought me up. My dad could sit out in the backyard and read the stars and predict the weather like 3 or 4 days in advance, and be right 100% of the time. It was amazing to me. I've talked to my Tio Spaye, my extended family, my people up at the Pokagon Reservation, and all of them tell me your dad would have been a holy man in the tribe because he was able to do that. He had this connection to the sky, and that's automatic. That's a resume buster right there.
Right.
So I've always, I've always had that that American Indian, it's always been in me. I even tell people, I've heard the Lakota language, which is really, it's kind of amazing. I'm still baffled by it. I've talked to my spiritual people about it. I've talked to my medicine man about it. This is a language, the Lakota language I've had in my head my entire life. I just don't know what it was. I just didn't know what it was until I start studying it. And it's like, that's weird. I can't understand, because my grandmother wasn't raised Lakota. She was raised basically white Christian in a way, in an Indian family that was being, kind of mainstream, white, farm.
But some of this also maybe came through your father?
It came through my father. Some of it came through my father. And I've always been had a connection to that and to any issues, even when I was a kid. For instance, I'm a lifelong Chicago Bears fan. Ever since I can remember, I used to ask my dad. I was like, I'd be like 7, 8 years old. I asked my dad. Why does the Washington football team call themselves that? I said, isn't that bad? And not even my dad even could have me. He said, yeah, it is bad, but not even dad could have a word for it. I've always been keen to,
sensitive to.
Very sensitive, extremely sensitive. In 1973, during the Wounded Knee siege with the American Indian Movement, Russell Means and Dennis Banks and them, when they took over Wounded Knee, my family, we sent supplies then by, and this wasn't like now with Standing Rock, where there was, activities all over the country, where people could send donations and, or take, send clothing or, you know, whatever they needed. This was back where the FBI had the whole area cordoned off. They had the army up there. I mean, it was crazy. And my family, we loaded up a pickup truck at my family's farm in Illinois. And I was in high school. And loaded up with food, with canned goods, and warm clothes, and, you know, and all that. And we heard that they got through up there. So, you know, I mean, long story short, I've been involved with, you know, all my life. I've really had I've been very close with my culture and my heritage. And I couldn't do it. I could not do a record without incorporating that. And I love the I first heard the Ribbentown Singers on their CD, and then I saw them at the powwow, and then I saw them at a couple other events where they played and the dancers were there and all that. And I started again when I started writing Killer and His Brother. I had that in mind to bookend that song with a native, with an authentic native, you know, drumming group. Mm-hmm. And what that turned into was coming out of a Killer and His Brother, which also features the great J.J. Kent on flute. J.J.'s Lakota and Cree, and he's he was a Nashville musician for a long time, so he knows his way around the studio. He played guitar too, but he makes his own flutes and he goes around the country, you know, educating people on, you know, Lakota legacy and legend and the history and the, you know, and the
culture
and the culture and the, you know, the spirituality behind behind the flute, you know, and all that. And I got him to lay that track down. I was just thrilled when he said he could do it. You know, he lives up in Rapid City, so he recorded it up there, and then we were emailing tracks back together. But after we did Young Ghetto's Call, which opens with Russell Means, you know, How Mataqua Pay, I decided to come out of, I thought it would be perfect to come out of A Killer and His Brother with the Ribbentown Singers.
Across the floor, father shouted behind them, shut a steely door. The three of them sat down at a table for four. Father Sean prays for meaning. Laid dead with a bullet in her eye. fired by government's disadvantageous desire. Father Sean prays for meaning.
Led right into Yahama Taquipe, Me Ama Lakota. And then you got Ricky David coming in with this hip hop thing.
Right.
Which, I mean, if I don't mind saying so myself, it's pretty powerful.
It is, and it's a little bit of a something fresh on the record. You go from maybe playing a lot of blues, and then there's some R&B, and there's some there's also some of the Native American Indian stuff, and then to go into a hip hop song was a surprise, but it also is very enjoyable.
I get a kick out of these musicians that spend all their time, and I mean they can even have good songs, you know. They spend all their time and energy and their money going into a studio and they're recording these songs, and then they come out and say, "Man, I'm so man, what a great session, man! I sound just like Stevie Ray Vaughan on that song, you know, or I sound like this, or I sound like that." I don't know. I don't want to sound like anybody but me.
You're telling your story.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and Junghetto's Call has a purpose. You know, and I remember where now Junghetto's Call was taken from Billy Nix's CD from the 2000. I think he recorded Junghetto in 2006. And there's a couple other things that I want to do on my next record, taking some more stuff from him, his record, and redoing it with his help. And he and I already talked about it. But we were just talking one day about, we were at breakfast one day, Billy and I, we were talking about that song, you know, about the album. And then he started talking about this 7/8 time that he was doing, you know, that he was working on on his own. And we got together and rehearsed him doing a 7/8 time on the drums and me backing it up with like with a 4/4 time with a conga, you know, with the congas on more, which kind of lent a really tribal feel to it. And I told him, I said, "This is going to be the middle part of this. Let's make this version." You know, we'll revise what you've got already, and we'll turn it into like a 9:32 hip hopera, like I like to call it. And we will, and we can speak to all ages. So we start out. We've got Ricky David, you know, and the young 3-time Michiana producer, hip hop producer of the year, looking for number 4. I think the awards are coming up in another month or so. He laid the rap down for that, which has captured the attention of all the young folks since I've had that. I brought in Willie, my man Willie Waldman, you know, who did all the hip-hop stuff. Willie was on, besides being on all the Memphis stuff with Al Green and, you know, those people down there with his mentor, Herman Green. Willie was out in L.A. in the early 90s, and he recorded. He was on Tupac's One Love California, I think.
Snoop Dogg, right?
He was on Snoop Dogg's Dog Father. Yeah. And he was on Dr. Dre's. I think he was on Dre 2001, if I'm not mistaken. So, you know, so he had that, you know, and when he came in, he was like double tracking and triple tracking horns over each other. Like he'd been doing it all his life. Oh, he is phenomenal. So we came out of the young man's hip hop into, and of course that's the voice of Malcolm X that we pulled off C-SPAN, by the way. So it's public, you know, for public consumption. Sure. You know, I don't need a copyright on it or anything. But we pulled the voice, you know, by any means necessary, and then it goes into that tribal thing in the middle, where we're able to touch on at the very end the Black Lives Movement, you know, Black Lives Matter movement with, you know, Hands Up, Don't Shoot, which I think is one of the most poignant slogans I think I've ever heard because, you know, okay, I know growing up I was always like, man, you know, if you got a gun, don't shoot somebody unless they got a gun. You know, you're not supposed, even on the old Westerns, you listen.
Right.
You know, I mean, don't shoot anybody in the back, you know, and never shoot anybody who's unarmed. Well, you know, today, that's not the case, especially when the cop has a gun and the black guy is driving while black.
Right.
You know, that's all he's doing, you know, and now you've got this whole faction that's even use that Black Lives Matter, you know, that Hands Up, Don't Shoot. Oh, well, that's just a myth. Well, no, it's not. That's not a myth.
And you know firsthand, being New York City, being in the Chicagoland area,
firsthand,
and writing about these things.
Exactly. I've been covering them for years, you know, and, you know, when somebody puts their hands up, they're like, you know, you know, it's like, I surrender.
That's
you know,
a universal sign for don't shoot.
Universal sign, please don't shoot me.
Right.
You know, and you know, so I thought that chant alone, top with, again, here's my Indian coming in, with Matakwe Oyasim, which means we are all related.
Right.
You know, I just thought those two went hand in hand, and so we segued them in. that's Chandra screaming, "Oh, that's my baby!" after the gunshots, you know. And then we've got the voice of God and Billy Nix doing that old school rap laid down behind a funk, just an old school funk beat, you know. And then that comes, and then when that ends, that comes back into the Ribbon Town Singers, which the Indian, which just takes them out.
Dripping off the rose petals. More money, more enemies. High fashion, dope cars, expensive accessories. Money can buy you happiness, but not everything. Blank picture frames with no memories. They say teamwork makes the dream work. It's a celebration, we gon' drink till we get my. Back to the cake, we gon' get it like it's D's. I'm with Billy on the drums, he gon' make this thing work. Yeah. It's that Joe Ghetto car. Hey, yo, Nix, I see you. Jeff, I see you. Charger. Willie. Yeah. We on. Let's go.
To bring about the freedom of these people by any means necessary. By any means necessary. By any means. To bring about the freedom of these people by any means necessary.
Another baby child becomes a boneyard pig. Part of our system, it seems, has become savage like the wild beast in the jungle. It would seem, too, that the hearts and minds of most of mankind has morally become decayed like one big filthy ghetto. Crack, cocaine, heroin, and booze. Four of many things that's making a lot of fools. The violence, immorality, racism, the greed, signs that most of mankind refuse to take real heed. Night smog, polluted night air, rhythms of the city throbbing everywhere. The sound you hear and the moods you feel set the stage for sin, it seems all too real. Beautiful young people, all moving fast, trying to hold on to life as it rushes past. Dealers, gangbangers, trigger happy and quick. Another baby child becomes a boneyard pig. Politicians' promises, package deals. Drug dealers selling dreams on wheels. Some will score, but some will fall. They'll fall victims of Junghetto's call. Junghetto's call, it promises the best of cars, clothes, homes, and all the other things that we call success. It's the dreamer's pot, the diamond key, the one big score that sets you free. Mankind's total disrespect for our Heavenly Father. Some children's disrespect for their parents, and some parents' disrespect for their children. The selfishness, the greed, the hungry and the homeless, the gangbangers, the street criminal and the thieving Mr. Nice Guy, white collar criminal, the child abuse, and those wild animals that call themselves men who beat, misuse, and abuse women and children, and those mothers who misuse, murder, abuse, dealt children, and abuse some men. The corrupt politicians, the police brutality, and our double standard system of justice. All those sanctimonious hypocrite preachers with their big business ministries playing with our Heavenly Father because of their own selfish greed for power and money.
Junghetto's call.
Man's inhumanity to his fellow man. There will never be enough to spread it all around. 'Cause a few rich, greedy people got it locked up town. But all hungry people, big and small, can't resist Junghetto's call.
Junghetto's call.
You know, I just kind of thought to myself, the Indians, you know, the Indians were here first, so let them take my record out because they're going to be there for the next one. So that was my basic premise.
And you talk about painting a picture. I mean, that's a very vivid picture that you just talked about.
I think that's, you know, I think that's the job of any songwriter or any writer or any creator. You know, you've got to, you know, like, I know reporting. I mean, I would go out, you know, I would cover the most mundane stuff. Well, I would just think to myself, you know, I want people to read what I write. I'm just not going to send them, you know, so-and-so across the street today and then went home and got lunch and, you know, and that's the end. You know, I always set out, every time I set out to write, whether it was a, you know, two or three paragraph brief or a feature story or a song or whatever, I want to paint a picture with words. That's my gift. I wake up and pray every morning. You know, I do my Indian ceremony every morning, and I thank the Creator for the gifts He has bestowed on me, my writing and my music, top of the list. You know, and that's my job as a writer. That's anybody's job as a writer. You've got to paint a picture with words. Otherwise, the people look at it, and it's just like they'll just put it down and go about their business.
What do you think about someone going into an art gallery and just passing by something, passing by a beautiful painting?
Yeah.
Do you want to captivate people? You want to get their attention, and you want them to think?
Yes, yes.
And you've done that?
Yes. Well, thank you.
Okay. You were talking about Billy Sticks Nicks. For the people who don't know, could you tell us about who Billy is?
Billy Sticks Nicks, I am blessed to have Billy Sticks Nicks in my life. And, I mean, you know, when I moved back here from New York in 2011, I came back here with three. The only thing that was going good for me out there was my job. You know, it was my job as a reporter. I had a miserable home life, a miserable personal life. I had no personal life. And when I came back here, I wanted to get my health back. I wanted to get my life back. And, you know, and honestly, I hadn't played music since I was out there. I only played a couple times. But I wanted to get that back, too. And I met Billy. I did a story on Billy for the Tribune, the South Bend Tribune. Mm-hmm. And we were talking. We were in his little studio that he had in his where he gives lessons. And he had this little house over there not too far from Notre Dame. And we were sitting in there, and we were talking, and then we started talking about drums, and we started talking about blues. And I said, you know, I told him, I said, I separate the men from the boys, drummers with blues, for the guys that can play a shuffle, and the guys that can't. That shuffle separates them.
Sure does, yeah.
And I told him, I said, Billy, I'm not afraid to tell you, I play one of the best shuffles in the world. He's like, well, show me. And I sat down, and I did. And the smile comes on his face, and he's like, you know what you're doing, don't you? I said, well, I said, yeah, I would, believe me, in front of you, I wouldn't have even been tempted to get up on your drums.
Right.
But I know what I know. 2 days later, he called me up, and he says, would you be interested in playing? You know, he says, come over. I want to talk to you. I have a proposition for you. He says, I'm looking for a conga player. I'm looking for somebody to play percussion. And he says he was going to get a guy. He wanted to get a saxophone player, but he says, no, I want a percussionist. And he said, I want you. Well, we went out to breakfast the next week, and we were talking about it. And, you know, he was telling me about the job. And he said, you know, Jeff, he says, our Heavenly Father put us two together for a reason. And I thought about that because I really didn't know him that well at the time. And but he has since, Billy Nicks, who before I get off the beaten path here, Billy Nicks played with Junior. He was a founding member of Junior Walker and the All-Stars. What was the song? Let's see. He was on the studio versions of How Sweet It Is to Be Loved by You. He was the drummer. I think he was on Pucker Up Buttercup, and he was on Roadrunner. Those, I forget what other there was another drummer that Junior was doing, because Billy went to the Navy for a while. And I know when Shotgun first came out, that was, I know the Billy was still, I don't know if he was back yet. But when Billy came back, then he rejoined Junior, and then, and that was around 64, 65. They were, with Junior Walker and the All-Stars back then with Billy, were the only full band on the Motown touring bus. Now, this bus carried, that went from city to city, sure, carrying the Motown Roadshow, had Marvin Gaye, the Four Tops, the Temptations, the Supremes, the Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, Mary Wells, did I say Wilson Pickett? Well, and Wilson Pickett, well, was on too. It was those, I know those people, there might have been another group or two on there, but
that's Junior, pretty heavy.
Junior Walker and the All-Stars would always come out first, and they would start the show off. Then the band would stay on, and then they'd start bringing
they'd
these
be the
people
house
up.
Band.
So Billy played with virtually every Motown artist there was. Knew them all. Billy Nix, not only has he taught three-quarters of South Bend how to play drums, he's been given instructions forever. You know, I'll tell you what he is in my life. He's like a father figure. He's a mentor. He's a friend. The man's special. I can't say enough about him. And I mean, there's a reason why Billy Nix was put on this planet. And believe me, he's far outweighed any expectations that, you know, that the creator might have had for him. I mean, he's an original dude. He's one of a kind, a true Motown legend. You may not hear about him, and people in, you know, Tupelo, Mississippi, or, you know, Topeka, Kansas, or some of these other people, you know, who may have heard of Marvin Gaye, and they may, you know, those guys, they may not have heard of Billy, but let me tell you something, Billy is right up there on that mountain.
And they've heard his music.
Absolutely, yeah. They've heard his music. Absolutely. Billy and James Jamerson are the only two Motown musicians to go from Detroit to L.A. and record. They're the only two of the Motown musicians to record at both Hitsville and Motown's records out in L.A.
Right.
Because they got completely separate people out there,
sure,
once they moved out there. So.
Cool. Well, talking about great people, do you have a story about performing with Dizzy Gillespie?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I was playing with, I'm going to date myself here. Let's go to 90, 91, maybe. Yeah, because I moved, but 91, possibly 92, early 92. And this is connected with my record too, by the way. Yeah, I was playing with a jazz singer in Fort Lauderdale named Tony Bishop, great, great singer, and Tony had her own club, and I was not only working steadily with Tony, my association with her, playing congas, congas and percussion, led me to meeting. I mean, I got, we were doing like jazz festivals and stuff, and I mean, I was meeting some of the, you know, greatest jazz musicians around. Wound up playing with Jaco Pastorius for a couple shows because he was in Fort Lauderdale. I knew Jaco pretty well, but that was through my association with Tony. Well, we were playing at the Hollywood Jazz Festival, and we opened up for Dizzy. Dizzy was the headliner, mm-hmm, on that night. And we opened up with him, and as I'm coming out, as I'm coming off the stage after our set, this very large black man in a really nice brown suit and gold, you know, gold chain and all that, you know, comes up to me and, you know, says, "Mr. Gillespie would like to have a word with you." I'm like, what? You know.
What have I done?
Yeah, exactly. This is what I do. You know, he says, "Follow me. Come with me." So I went down there. There was this room, or actually it wasn't a room. It was kind of like an area that they had off to the side. It was an outdoor amphitheater. There was an area out off to the side there that they had. It was like a tent area. And I went in there, and you know, there was Dizzy, you know, sitting in there, and he's about ready to go on. And he says, "Man, you you light up them congas. He said, what part of Cuba you from?
Wow.
I said, well, actually, I said, I'm not from Cuba. I said, I'm from Indiana. Indiana? Well, he goes, what's in Indiana? I go, well, you know, a lot of corn. You know? And But long story short, he said that his percussionist at the time had to go to New York, had to fly back immediately because Arturo Sandoval was deporting, was defecting from Cuba.
Okay.
Him and he had his family. Actually, his family was in New York, and but they had all the, you know, they had the legalities that they had. They had, you know, people that were supposed to meet him there. Well, the percussionist was going to meet them, and he was flying in from London. And the percussionist was going to meet him in New York and get him situated so Dizzy, when Dizzy got up there. And Dizzy had two shows before he could get up there. He had a show in Sarasota at the Van Wezel Auditorium, which was a beautiful auditorium, kind of like a Carnegie Hall almost. And then he had another show up in Orlando at Universal at a big amphitheater up there. And he told me, he says, he needed a conga player for two nights. And he says, do you have your car? I said, yeah, I got a car. And he says, well, if you can get over there, he says, I'll pay you. I'll set you up with room and board the one night. And then you go with us to Orlando. And then you, you know, come home. If that works for you, that works for me. And I said, great. I said, are we rehearsing? He goes, you don't need no rehearsal. And I'm like, you sure? He goes, yeah. Son, I heard you play. You don't need a rehearsal. And I remember the first night in Sarasota, went out, you know, before it's on. I said, he goes, you cool? I go, I think so. He goes, just play what you feel, brother. Just play what you feel. He goes, you don't need me. Just play. And that's what I did. I just kind of just swooped in under the groove, you know, and just did my thing.
And the Latin music was such an integral part of Dizzy's music.
Oh, it was huge.
Yeah. And how, do you think that experience changed you, or what? How did it affect you?
You know what it affected? It had a profound effect on me. It told me that if somebody on the legendary level of Dizzy Gillespie, a guy that I've been listening to all my life, you know, I mean, you know, well, the musical moon rises and sets with me, with Miles Davis.
Sure.
You know, Miles just, you know, even though I played blues, I really, you know, and my foundation was blues and, I mean, Chicago blues, you know, Delta blues. And, you know, some of this other stuff, Miles to me serves as the big picture. Well, Dizzy and all those guys, you know, kind of, you know, they're the forefathers.
Right, they're right there.
When somebody like that offers me a job and tells me, just play, that had such a huge effect on me. I can't tell you what kind of confidence that gave.
Sure.
You know, knowing that I was...
you could hang with the big boys.
Knowing that I could hang with the big boys and that they felt the same way. That was... And that allowed me... I'll tell you what it did to my playing. It made me try to open my... It made me try to use my hand, my left hand more, and be more ambidextrous in my hand patterns, which allowed me to do much more with the music and much more with, you know, with my instrument too. So in that sense, yeah, it had a... Playing with him just those two shows had a profound effect on me. And the cool part, which surfaced in my record, was... He had a young sax player playing with him at the time named Ron Holloway, who I reconnected with a couple of years ago through a friend of mine down in Dayton. And I was talking to my buddy. I said, I really want a sax player on my record. I'd love to have Ron play on my record. He says, I can get him. He says he'd do that. You know, well, we can do that. He says, you're paying? I go, yeah, I'm paying. I'll pay him whatever. Yeah, I'll pay him whatever he wants. I'll pay him his scale. You know. And I mean, the next day, you know, he gave me, shot me, texted me his number. I called Ron. Ron's like, yeah, I'd love to, man. You know, and Ron did not remember me from Dizzy's band. I barely remembered him.
It was probably 1,000 gigs ago or something.
It was, right? Yeah, you know, and thousands probably even undercutting things a little bit, you know. But I went down to a gig he had that my buddy had him at down in Dayton, and we talked and, you know, kind of reconnected like that. And now Ron Holloway plays with the Tedeschi Trucks Band. Matter of fact, he played with Susan mm-hmm. Tedeschi for a while. Plays with Warren Haynes still. And, I mean, he's in that mode too. Also played with Gil Scott Heron, who was one of my heroes growing up.
Yeah.
Who else? He played with Root Boy Slim back in the 70s and 80s. You know, and now this is Ron Holloway's a world class musician. You know, and,
so it's fun to kind of come full circle.
So it was huge to me with my record for this to come full circle with a guy like Ron, because Ron Holloway and I, and I've got to give my boy Jean Prosper props too. You know, Jean who studied under Oscar Peterson.
Mm-hmm.
Nuff said.
Right.
You know. And I met Jean in South Bend. He was living there. I think Jean's in Florida now. But met, you know, did a story, another story with him on at the Tribune, which is how we reconnected. And he was invaluable to me in the studio when I went in. He was just, not only is Ron a brilliant pianist, he's just a wonderful human being. He's just a wonderful dude, man. He's a great guy. You know, the intro to Master Midnight, the intro to the, which is basically the intro to the record.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted a Coltrane to Love Supreme type feel. And I gave those instructions both to Jean and to Ron. And they nailed it.
They took it and ran.
It yeah. was like yeah. it was like Coltrane and McCoy Tyner.
Right.
So, yeah, that Dizzy connection really, really, really not only was very profound for me at the time, it, you know, it stayed with me, you know, for my future reference. And I really hope to even include Ron. My plan is to, you know, if I am fortunate and blessed enough to be able to get out and do this thing the way I want to do it, you know, with a bus and the road and, you know, doing it right, you know, I really hope to have a guy like Ron, you know, with me.
Right. In passing, you mentioned you played with Jaco Pastorius.
Yeah.
I can't let that go by. Tell me about that.
That was funny, man. Jaco had when we, in the late 80s, this is when I was playing with Tony Bishop around Fort Lauderdale, doing most of my work with Tony. And Jaco, even though Jaco was married, had a beautiful wife, had two of the most adorable twin little girls that you could ever find. Jaco was a drunk. Jaco had right. his demons, you know. And Jaco chose to live homeless. He had a nice house in Pompano Beach, you know, with his family and everything. But he chose to live as a homeless bum in Holiday Park. You know, and Jaco was not poor by any stretch.
Right.
I mean, the stuff he wrote for Weather Report, those were, I mean, I remember the one tune he had was one of Weather Report's, like, they still play it on the radio,
right.
You know. Well, I got to know Jaco. Tony had her club across the street from Holiday Park. And so we used to see Jaco in there a lot. Not always in the greatest condition. Mm. I mean, he came out. I remember the one night we were playing, and you know, we were in the middle of a set, and I see Jaco come in the front door, and I see Tony's manager, you know, go running up to him, and you could just tell Jaco was like falling down drunk, and he wanted to sit in, you know, and the guy, no, you know, and the voices, and now this is, it was a small club, but it was packed, it was jammed to the rafters, and you could hear them kind of raising voices. So PJ, I see her manager just kind of like get his shoulders down and say, stay here. You know, I could just see him pointing to the ground. And then he went to some office. I don't know if he was going to get any money or get him something to get him out of there. But I looked up and Jaco was like got his pants down and he's taking a leak in the corner in front of all these people, you know, just... And I'm just thinking to myself, well, you know, this is not going to end good. Well, not long after that, Jocko got arrested for public indecency down on Fort Lauderdale Beach. Got for drunken, disorderly, and for public indecency. Apparently, he was got drunk and he was walking around the beach naked. Yeah, and so Jocko gets arrested, and the judge gives him community service, and his community service ends up being a concert. Matter of fact, I think he had to give three concerts, and each one was to benefit some
different charity.
Different charity. Yeah, whatever it was. And I know one was some kid's charity there that his wife was involved in too. So anyway, he recruited me to play congas. You know, they had, I know the one show, Pat Metheny came up and sat in.
Wow.
You know, because Pat Metheny was a University of Miami graduate, and I know they knew each other fairly well, too. And I know Pat Metheny played with him. I think Peter Erskine came in and played drums on a few songs on one of these shows, too. But anyway, I did all three shows with him, and working with the guy was a treat.
Yeah.
Because once you got Jocko, first of all, Jocko was a sweetheart. Jocko was an absolute sweetheart. He really was. When he got drunk, he was belligerent.
Yeah.
And he was like most drunks who can't handle their booze, you know, and they can't handle their emotions. And I mean, I've seen alcohol, you know, turn the most docile, sweetest individuals into these, like, you know, teeth bearing, you know, growling.
Monsters, yeah.
Yeah, monsters. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that's how Jocko could get, you know, on that. But working with him was a real treat. And he was another one of those guys. Yeah, he was like Dizzy, play by feel. You know, here's the songs, here's the basic format. You know the format and all that. But especially with congas, which is all feel anyway.
Sure.
You know, I mean, you know, percussion, especially when you get into congas, it's all technique and feel. That's basically what it is. And, you know, the time, you can really, really stretch time. And I feel, you know, as opposed to drums, to actual drum kit, where you serve as the motor of the band. You serve as, you know, and
the
you've
meter
got,
and keeping
the meter.
Yeah.
You've got to stay. It's a lot more rigid. You know, even you get a guy like Billy Cobham or somebody like that who likes to dance around the melody lines.
He always comes back to the one.
He always comes back to the one, and they always come back into him to revolve around him again. You know, congas isn't like that. Congas, you're like a sax player or a guitar player or another. It's like another realm, you know, musical realm.
Sure, more improvisational.
A lot more improvisational. There's a lot more room to stretch, you know, and a lot more room to take, you know, meters and grooves and just send them, you know, and turn it into like a voodoo ceremony, which is another thing I've done. You know, but that's what Jocko, and that's what playing with Jocko was like. And it was really cool.
Why the blues?
It's always been there.
Yeah.
For me. I heard my first, let's see. I gotta say, I heard my first blues record, I might have been like maybe 5 or 6. I forget who. My cousin had records. My cousin came to live with us for a while. Matter of fact, it was my cousin that took me to see the Beatles at the Indiana State Fair in '64. She had Elvis. You know, she had Elvis records. I remember she was into some country too. I remember Marty Robbins. I was listening to some her. I would go in her bedroom and put on, you know, put on records and play these records. The Beach Boys was another one. She came in, was it BB? She came in, I think, with a BB King record from like, and I'm talking, we're probably around 63, 64. I just instantly related to it. It was just something with me that just pulled me in right now.
Just resonated.
Just resonated. Right? Yeah, exactly. That's a good word for it. It just resonated with me as young as I was. And I remember not too long after that, I was over at a friend of mine's house, and he had his mother. I remember his mother, well, her talking about the blues. We got the blues, praise the Lord, we got the blues. I never forget this woman, talking like that. She put on Robert Johnson. Now, I'm like 7.
Wow.
In like 1964. A lot of these people, say, we heard Robert Johnson, I was in college in the 80s or, whatever. I'm talking early on, 1964, around there. And I remember sitting in my friend's house, and his mom had this Robert Johnson record on. And it was, it was just that, just Robert. Mm-hmm. It was Robert and then that makeshift thing in San Antonio.
Just low down.
And I just remember his voice being so just his voice. It was his voice that just really, really, I mean, as young as I was, it was bone chilling. It was haunting. I would think about his voice when I would, after that, when I would go home, or I was just playing around. And the blues has just been with me. That spirit was meant to be channeled into me. It's like a computer chip, I guess, maybe for a better analogy. But it was just something whatever that channel that I was born with. I was born to channel that music, that particular. I think I was born to channel music in general.
Sure.
But the blues, I recognized early on that the blues was the foundation to everything I heard. Country. Especially country.
Mm-hmm.
Country was nothing more than white men picking up a guitar and
singing the blues
and singing what the black men were chanting about in the fields,
right?
When I was in first grade, all the way through grade school, from first to eighth grade in Indianapolis, our music class, they always had we took music memory classes, and we had a test at the end of each semester. And it was the music memory test that they would pipe in from the, over a loudspeaker from a central office downtown. And we would name the songs. Well, eight straight years, I got 100 on these music memory tests. I never missed one. I got perfect scores every year. And we learned about Dvorak. We learned about Tchaikovsky. We learned about Beethoven, Stravinsky, and Copland. And, we learned about all these at a very young age. I was even recognizing blues.
So you just were in tune with music at a very young age.
I was in tune with that, but I heard the blues in everything. Especially, and I just mentioned a guy, especially Aaron Copland. Because he had that southwestern, flavor to his classical music, to his music. And if you listen to Copland really close, there's elements of black man's blues. Coming in there, for the cotton field blues, so to speak, and that he was able to pull out, why blues? It's just one of those things. It's a natural, it's just always been a natural fit with me, in my music. I mean, I don't know. If I didn't know the blues, I don't know where else I would have started.